Facebook is updating itself, so we'll not do that right now. But it's a very nice commentary, short commentary on the four immeasurables by Jigme Lingpa, a great Nyingma Lama. And it addresses it, it links them directly to the verses we're doing today. So we will come back to that. Oh. Okay, that was filed in the wrong place. All right, so now we'll do our meditation. Let me bring my notes to where I can see them. Meditation. All right, we're going to do a short meditation today because I want to leave time at the end to chant the Akshobhya mantra for Lama Norla Rinpoche. So we'll just begin by checking in again with our posture, just refreshing it, straight, sort of stable, grounded, and relaxed. And just take a moment to let our attention sink into our body, to permeate our whole body, letting go of any tension that we find, just being aware of how it feels to be in our body, not just in our thoughts, but really embodied in our seat, wherever we may be, in this present moment of awareness. And in this state of awareness, we will touch upon each of the four thoughts. Very important to begin our sessions with those whenever we can. So first, the precious human existence, just really feeling in our heart that sense of appreciation for this opportunity, for all the freedoms we have and all the resources that we have that make it possible for us to attain freedom in this lifetime or in a series of lifetimes, continuing to progress. And then second, impermanence and death, that it's a limited time opportunity. And if we don't make use of it now, we may lose it. Well, we will lose it, but we may lose it without making any, leaving ourselves in a position to move on to the next life in a positive way. Third, the law of karma, cause and result. The Buddha taught that our happiness, suffering, and liberation are completely dependent upon our actions in this lifetime. So we need to be very attentive to our actions and keep them in accord with the Buddha's teachings. And then fourth, that every experience that we have, everything we have in samsara is imbued with suffering, it leads to suffering. And so we need to aspire not only for happiness in this lifetime, but to actually free ourselves from samsara, the cycle of existence, so that we can then help other beings free themselves as well. And now we're going to touch base with ultimate bodhicitta, the nature of mind, and at the same time mix our mind with the Lama's mind or the Buddha's mind. It's all the same mind, the mind of enlightenment. But it can help sometimes if we have a visual sense and a visceral sense of someone who has attained it before. So we begin by visualizing the Lama or the Buddha on the crown of our head, just floating above the crown of our head on a lotus and moon seat. It's a flat lotus and a flat moon. And the Lama or the Buddha is sitting on that in Vajra posture, radiating light, radiating love and compassion, radiating wisdom, radiating awakening, vividly visualizing as much as we can that he or she is really there. The Buddha said that whenever we bring him to mind, he is actually present with us. And that is true of the Lama as well. The realized Lama. And we think in a heartfelt way that we wish to attain what the Lama has attained, to realize what the Lama has realized, wisdom, love, and compassion, awakening. And that we ask for his or her blessings to accomplish this. Because the Lama and the Buddha, if we think of them, can really help us. Devotion is a very key component of awakening on the Vajrayana path. And now we think that we have received the Lama's or the Buddha's blessing, and we imagine them descending through the crown of our head into our heart. And so the Lama or the Buddha in our heart center is continuing to radiate love, compassion, wisdom, and awakening. The light filling the room. This is a good visualization we're often taught to do as we're falling asleep, is to think of the Lama in our heart, radiating light, illuminating the entire room. And knowing that the Lama and the Buddha are internal to us. And this visualization is helping to activate that internally to us. We mix our mind with the Lama's mind and the Buddha's mind and just rest in that state. It's the same state of open awareness and recognition that we cultivate through the four steps in the Great Path of Awakening. So we'll just rest like that for a minute or two. Really having a sense of the Lama's presence, the Buddha's presence. Really having a sense that our mind is the same as their mind. And they are helping to illuminate that for us. Eyes can be open or closed. Mind is alert, but very relaxed, very receptive. Feeling not only the Lama's and the Buddha's presence, but also their realization, their wisdom, their love and compassion. We are bathed in their awakening. And now within the state of our mind being mixed with the mind of enlightenment through the Buddha or through our Lama, we can begin to do taking and sending, thinking of all sentient beings throughout the universe, filling all of space, all of them experiencing some kind of suffering. And if there are any particular beings that we wish to bring to mind, that's fine too. For example, anyone who has been a victim of violence in recent weeks. Anyone who is experiencing grief or sadness. Anyone who is experiencing fear and anger. And with the Lama and the Buddha in our heart center, we breathe in all the suffering of beings. letting it dissolve along with our breath, dissolving into our vast Buddha nature, and breathing out to all sentient beings happiness, love, compassion, wisdom, healing, peace. And we'll continue to do this on every set of breaths, or every few breaths, whatever's more comfortable. So we want to get a good sense of the presence of the Lama, of the Buddha. Thinking that when we breathe in the suffering of beings, they are freed from it, and that suffering simply dissolves into our Buddha nature. And that they really, really receive the happiness, healing, and peace that we send them, and the love and compassion and awakening of the Buddha. And we can think now that all beings are freed from suffering and filled with happiness, and all beings, including ourselves, are completely awakened, and our minds are completely mixed with the mind of the Lama, the Buddha, the mind of awakening. And this should make us feel very joyous. And now we can let go of the visualizations. The Lama and the Buddha still remain in our heart, but we don't have to continue to visualize it. And just returning to following our breath, and then returning to just open awareness. And now. Hello. Hey, Richard.
It's Richard. I don't feel like being seen today. So I just turned off my camera.
That's fine. Welcome to class. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. I just got out of a long wait, and I'm not prepared to be seen.
Okay. Well, it was nice to see you for a moment. We've just finished our meditation.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No problem. We're glad to have you here, and we had finished. We were just coming back to regular awareness.
Okay.
Okay.
Where I live.
I'm going to mute you now.
Okay.
Excellent timing, actually. All right. So here we are. Next, we are going to chant the verses. Let me find the screen share. Did anybody have anything, before we share screen, did anybody have anything that they wanted to say or ask? If you do, you can just raise your hand or unmute yourself. Okay, I'm going to unmute you, Angela.
Is it okay to do the chant for Rinpoche even if we don't have the empowerment by ourselves?
Yes, it is. It's fine to do the mantra. The mantra is fine. You just wouldn't do the full practice. And it's not even that there's any harm in doing the full practice. It's just that you don't have the empowerment, so it's not effective to do it.
Okay. But
if you're in a group and someone is leading it who has the empowerment, then it's fine to chant the whole practice with them. We'll be doing that in Richmond a couple of times this week, tonight and Sunday. So that's a great question. Thank you for asking. And at the end, as I said, before everybody was here, we're going to do a few minutes of the Akshobhya mantra for Lama Narwa Rinpoche. I have it online. I'll have a screen share for that. Anybody else? Okay, then we are going to, I'm going to share the screen. And we're gonna chant all the verses this week because I'm over the flu. And we are up to verses 20 and 21 this week. We're going to do them both together. If you looked at my post, then you'll understand why. Or if you looked at the verses, you probably understand why. But today we're going to have the whole review. So let's really do this with a lot of focus, a relaxed focus, but really being attentive to the meaning of what we're chanting and what each practice is that we are committing to or studying if we're not feeling like completely committing. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind to leave behind my habits and reactions. This homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives, when solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stay. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Not sure where that came from. Somebody's drawing on the screen. Who can the worldly deities protect? Themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail. The three jewels which embody freedom's path. Reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So those are the seven preliminary practices, which are ongoing practices for all of us. And the three levels of motivation, the sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each grass, the realm of happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts just for that, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now we enter upon action bodhicitta, taking and sending in verse 11 and then 12 through 21 to is bodhisattva boot camp, bringing all experience onto the path. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone. While focusing on others' benefit, gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness or others' suffering. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone puts off my head to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone slanders me and spreads the word, maligning me throughout the universe, to pay them back, I fill my heart with love, extolling their good traits and character. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone tells a crowd my hidden faults and speaks of me with undisguised contempt, to see them as my spiritual friend and bow sincerely with respect to them, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone I've cared for as my own child turns on me as their worst enemy, then like a mother when her child is ill, to shower them with more love than before, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone my inferior or peer through pride disparages and puts me down, to honor them as I would my teacher and place them reverently on my crown, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I've lost everything and everyone abuses me and treats me with contempt, I'm stricken by disease and very sick, on top of that a demon's in my head, to take on all the suffering of beings completely free of all discouragement, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've achieved the pinnacle of fame and the whole world bows down to me in awe, I'm rich beyond my very wildest dreams. Whatever money buys, I have it all. To see that there's no essence in success and never think I'm better than the rest, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And now today's verses. I think we have time to chant them. Let's chant them twice each. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply. No matter how to vanquish them, I fight to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply. No matter how to vanquish them, I fight to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. In verse 21, sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's what we're working with this week. It's sort of the crux of the matter. Like we all know this, that the point of the Dharma is to tame our emotional afflictions, which are vividly, you know, brought to us in verse 2 about leaving our homeland. While those I love can stir up a tsunami and those I hate can burn me up like fire. So desire and anger, two sides of the same coin. And so for those of you who had a chance to look at the post on this that I posted a few days ago, I put up a contemplation, which was also kind of a question to come up with the answer to. And the question was, can I remember how I put it? I can't. How do I put that? Let me check. So We'll just have a little technology gap for a moment. Try to find. That way. Okay. Almost there. Okay, so the contemplation was, what is the most basic principle of mind training that is a bodhicitta in two words? Anybody remember the two-word summary of what mind training is about, the point of mind training? Yes.
I don't know. This kind of sticks in my mind. Others first.
That's it.
Basic.
That's it. That's it. That's it. Lama Karma Samten, who taught at KTC in 2016, he said he began his weekend seminar on mind training by saying, you can boil it down to just two words, others first. That's all you really have to remember in any situation. And our tool for helping to remember that and our tool for putting it into practice is what? Are you raising your hand, Angela? Yes.
Tonglen.
Yes, Tonglen. Tonglen is how we put others first into practice. So that should be our go-to. When we feel an emotion arising, let's say desire or anger, or somebody does something, any of the Bodhisattva boot camp things happen to us, we're trying to develop the reflex that our mind immediately goes to others first and puts into practice taking and sending. If we can develop that reflex, we'll be fine. Nothing can harm us if we have that reflex. Nothing can harm us mentally, say. Anybody else have anything to say on this? So how does, the other half of the question is, how does this principle, others first, how does this apply to verses 20 and 21? What's happening, like, when you are consumed with anger or consumed with desire? I'm unmuting you, Fanny. It's not unmuting for some reason. Okay, there we go. You're unmuted, I think. Okay, hold on. Don't touch the screen yet. Okay, I think you're unmuted. No, it's not unmuting for you somehow. I'm going to unmute everybody and see if that unmutes you. Okay, try it now, Fanny. No, you seem to be permanently muted. You're welcome to type it. Anybody want to jump in and say what is happening in verses 20 and 21? Marilyn. Okay.
The reverse. The reverse.
What's the reverse of others first?
Yeah, we're just watching how we're just absorbed in how we feel and what we want or what we don't want.
Yes, that would be my answer too. Anybody have any other thoughts on it? So thank you, Marilyn. And Fanny, I know that was what you were going to say too, something along those lines.
Self-absorption. Okay. Self-absorption.
Yeah, self-absorption. Who said that?
Fanny.
Fanny, we can hear you. Okay. All right, Joanne, yes.
Two words, ego clinging.
Right, ego clinging. You're coming up with all the answers.
No, I'm just, you're a good teacher.
So I'm trying to mute everybody now that I unmuted so that we don't get any background noise. And yes, so that's it. That's all we have to remember. Others first. And when we're not putting others first, we're caught in ego clinging, which self-absorption would be a perfectly good synonym for ego clinging, I think, or for me first, or team I. We're on team I. These are all, phrases that if we could just have them handy when the emotion starts to come up, then we could take the action that we need to take and we could tame our mind. But it's not easy. It's simple, but not easy, like so many things in life that are good. So, okay, great to see you, Fanny. Thank you for joining us. All right. So anybody have anything else to say? I mean, we all know this. This is like the simplest thing in the world. Others first. That's all we have to remember. So does anybody have anything to add before we're going to take a quick look at the commentaries. I didn't find any commentary that had a lot that we probably needed to go over in class, but I picked out some really little pithy things from several of them. So we'll look at that. And again, if anybody has anything to say at any time, you know how to get my attention, and hopefully it will work. Let's see. Oh, actually, what I'm going to do now is see if I can open Facebook and read that quote about the four immeasurables, because it's completely relevant here. So we have another little technology gap that you can use to rest in open awareness. Okay, so here it is. It's on Just Dharma Quotes. That's like something that I liked on Facebook a couple of years ago, and they just have all kinds of great quotes all the time. And often they're like relevant to what we're doing. So this is from Jigme Lingpa on the Four Immeasurables. He says, love means wishing for the happiness of others. It's like a loving mother cherishing her child, one's body, wealth, and virtue all amassed, one gives for others' benefit while training to endure the harms that they inflict. So when we really love someone, we don't tend to react the same way to their aggression, say, as we do to somebody we don't like. Very quick to jump on somebody we don't like, but somebody we love, it's like verse 16 here, you know, like a mother with her child, when they turn on you, it just increases your love. You totally understand why they're doing what they're doing, and you can make space for it. So that's love. You give them anything and you would take anything from them. So the second of the four measurables is compassion. And Jigme Lingpa says, compassion is a powerful state of mind, an inability to tolerate the fact that others suffer. So that's what's meant by the phrase that we often see, which is unbearable compassion. When we do taking and sending, we generate unbearable compassion, which means that you have to do something. If all you can do is taking and sending, then you do taking and sending. If you can jump in and save them from being hit by a car, then you do that. So an inability to tolerate the fact that others suffer. Beings in the six realms are entrapped by sorrow and its cause, and seeing this brings tears to one's eyes. So this is where we're allowed to cry, you know, as bodhisattvas, is when we see others suffering. We see that they're entrapped by their own wish to be happy, which they and we could say we, tend to approach in a counterproductive way. We think yelling at that person, yelling back at that person will bring us happiness. We think getting that thing that we want, having another slice of pie, you know, whatever it is that we're addicted to, we think that's going to make us happy. And so seeing that pattern brings tears to the eyes of a bodhisattva, because the bodhisattva knows that it's really only ending in suffering. So the third one is sometimes a little hard to understand just from the words in the Four Immeasurables. It's called joy or happiness, like true happiness. True happiness that's sort of uncorrupted by suffering. So Jigme Lingpa says, joy is to delight in others' pleasure and success. It is to cultivate the wish that all have happiness. It is a joy one feels when they achieve it for themselves, and is the wish that they should never be deprived of it. So it means that you didn't get the job, but you rejoice for the person who got the job. So you're happy, like no matter what. You're not dwelling on the fact that you didn't get something. You're others first. You are instead turning your attention to how that person feels. And that allows you to have what's called sympathetic joy. So wouldn't it be wonderful if we could always apply that? And so now here comes the part that relates directly to verses 20 and 21, is the fourth, equanimity or impartiality. both words are used in the Four Immeasurables. Impartiality is freedom from attachment and hostility, which is verse 20. 20 is hostility or aggression or anger. Verse 21 is attachment or desire. Impartiality is being free from those two things. Equanimity is being free from those two things. Not being like a stick of wood and not having any emotions, but just always being able to find the sympathetic joy in everything. Always being able to be on team other. If we're on team other, then we don't react with anger and we don't react with desire because we're thinking of others first. So impartiality is freedom from attachment and hostility. When sides and factions are all seen as equal, when enemy and friend, and neither, meaning someone you're indifferent to, are all treated with an even hand and kindness. We should practice these four attitudes, remembering that all is without true existence. None of it will matter in 100 years anyway. So why is it a big deal in this moment? So I just thought that was really helpful. And when we chant the Four Immeasurables now, we can sort of have a link to the 37 practices. And again, Dengo Chenzi Rinpoche, in an earlier verse, I think it was verse 11, said we should become very familiar with the Four Immeasurables. So we're going to look. We have about a half hour left before we're going to turn our attention towards Akshobhya. So we're going to just look at a couple of things in the commentaries. Again, anybody have anything they want to say before we do that? Okay, I'm going to unmute you, Joanne.
Just backtracking to the Four Immeasurables. Mm-hmm. In my way of just emailing me the name of the Rinpoche, I'm trying to do it phonetically so I can access that commentary. Can we access that online?
The one that I just read, I'll copy it and send it to you. How about that?
Okay. And with
on Facebook, you could find it. But if you're not on Facebook, it's a little trickier.
I don't do Facebook.
Yes, I don't blame you. I don't recommend it. I do it for a couple of specific reasons.
I understand.
And I find it helpful in certain ways, but I don't recommend it. It's a big waste of time. So I'm just making myself a note to send it to you. And hopefully I will see that. And if you don't get it, like today, I'll let me know and I'll send it. All right. So anybody else? All right. We're going to look first at Dengo Chenzi Rinpoche. For verse 20, it's on page 132 if you're looking in the book. I'm just going to pick out a couple of pithy statements. He says, the way to master hatred, the way to like tame hatred, is to meditate one-pointedly on patience and love. And we're going to hear more about that from Gampopa shortly. He says, once love and compassion take root in your being, there can be no outer adversaries. Once you overcome the hatred within your own mind, and hatred here is a bad translation. It's really like hatred is like the extreme end of aversion, aggression, anger, hatred. So I would say aggression or anger here. Once you overcome aggression within your own mind, you will discover that in the world outside, there is no longer any such thing as even a single enemy. So that's the promise of this verse, is that if we tame our own anger, nobody will make us angry. Anger always comes from our own inner anger, meeting like an outer circumstance that triggers it. So if there's no button to push, and I used to think of it in these terms, when somebody would get my goat, I would think, I gotta deactivate that button. Not totally successfully, you know, it's a work in progress, but the point is to deactivate the buttons. And then, again, nothing can harm you. So, and then he says, never get angry, even with someone who's deliberately and maliciously harmed you. So we're going to talk more about how to actually do that. In a few minutes. This is the inspiration to tame our minds, and then we're going to get the methods, which we've all heard before, but I'm going to, point you in a couple of directions to refresh that as we need to. He says, it is a crucial point of the teachings to become conscious that attachment, aversion, and ignorance are your oldest enemies, and that once you have overcome them, there are no further enemies in the world outside. So I wanted to say, and I think I may have said this in the post, that these two verses really fit in with Bodhisattva Boot Camp. Like they're the last verses of Bodhisattva Boot Camp. You know, what do you do when anger comes, or when someone makes you angry? Taking and sending, team other, you tame the anger. What do you do when you're overcome with desire? Say, you know, think in terms of an addiction. What do you do when you're overcome with that? You think, team other, you tame it. So we're going to, and so they fit in, these two verses fit in with the Bodhisattva Root Camp verses, but they also fit in with the next verse and the next set of verses. Verse 22 is going to be about nature of mind. We're getting into like the next three verses after this, our ultimate bodhicitta, how to relate to the nature of mind. And so when we're not in touch with the nature of mind, that's ignorance. That's the definition of ignorance. And so you got the three poisons. Verse 20 is the poison of anger. Verse 21 is the poison of desire. And verse 22 is going to be the poison of ignorance. So these two verses are kind of a bridge between like the last of the relative bodhicitta verses and the beginning of the ultimate bodhicitta verses through the mechanism of the three poisons. So here Dingbo Chenzi is going to give us a preview of how we go about taming these emotions. He says, examine anger itself. Like anger comes up, and instead of looking at the person or the thing that's making you angry, you turn your attention to the anger itself and you look at that. And you will find that it is nothing but a thought. So remember, like step one, well, really step two, step one is to recognize that you're angry. And step two is to drop the storyline, because it's the storyline that feeds the anger. And so that's what he's saying here. If we look directly at the anger, we find that it is nothing but a thought. And if we drop the thoughts, then the anger dissipates. Not instantly necessarily, but we're left then with the feeling of what the anger is, and not with the pointing the finger and blaming someone else or something else, which increases our anger and sort of makes it indelible. He says, if that angry thought disappears, it will not lead to an action done in anger with its negative karmic results. So there's our big advantage. If we could just do that and not act on the anger, not speak out of anger and not act out of anger, then we don't end up with negative karma. And anger is like as negative as karma can get. He says, trample on anger with realization, which reminds me of Kathy's, you know, Kathy's wording that she got from, I think, the eight verses. Trample it or stomp. Kathy, do you remember? Are you here? Where are you, Kathy? Oh, Kathy. Kathy, are you there and do you remember? Uh-huh. Can you remember that worded again?
It's you face and avert it.
Face and avert it. Okay.
Face and avert, yeah.
Okay, thank you. So here he's saying trample on anger with realization. And that's what Trungpa Rinpoche uses similar imagery to. He says stomp on it. When the kleshas arise, the negative emotions, stomp on them. You can use a blunt instrument here, because what you're doing is saving yourself from a lot of suffering in the future. If only you could have the presence of mind to think in those terms as it arises. So trample on anger with realization. I love that. Trample on anger with realization, and it dissolves like a cloud in the sky. And as it dissolves, the notion of enemy will vanish with it. So that's what Dingo Chenzi has to say on verse 20. I'm probably not going to get to everything I wanted to read, but you all have some of the commentaries. Let's see if I have something from... Geshe Jampa Tegcho in Transforming the Heart tells us that there are three types of attachment according to time, one for each of the three kinds. Our attachment towards our favorite music, clothing, and food is called craving for the present. Like, I want the ice cream. That's craving for the present. When we feel, may I always have these things, I never want to be separated from these pleasures, This is called craving that aspires for the future. Like, I want more ice cream after this. I never want to have to stop eating ice cream. That is craving or attachment for the future. And recollecting past enjoyments with fond memories, we yearn for them again. That is called craving for the past. Gosh, I remember the ice cream I ate last summer. It was so good. I really wish I had that now. So I just thought that was really interesting. He goes on, but I'm going to leave it there. Oh, and he said one other. Oh, but that's verse 21. Oh, I'm sorry. I got into verse 21. It's a little hard to keep these things separate. Okay, he has something on verse 20 as well. He says, oh yeah, this is a reminder. He says, if we tame our mind from anger, external enemies cannot harm us, which is what the verse basically says. The Buddha vanquished the hordes of beings who came to harm him, not with bombs and guns, but with the enormous power of his love and compassion. So he was, like, various people tried to harm him after his enlightenment, and he always met them with love and trying to help them. He never tried to hurt them in return. His cousin Devadatta tried to kill him on numerous occasions. He never responded with anger. He always responded with love, and in the end, he was able to help Devadatta. But when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree in meditation, sort of seeking enlightenment, the hordes of Mara attacked him. The armies of Mara attacked him, or they shot arrows at him, and through his love, he turned the arrows into flowers. So I just wanted to remind everybody of that via Geshe Jompa Tenchuk. Okay, so we're going to look now. I have something from the Temple Sutra. He has the same story of the Buddha. So we're going to look at verse 12. So that's anger. We're going through this quickly. I don't know, you know, if it's helpful or not, but hopefully it is. So looking at verse 21, we'll just look quickly at what Dingo Chense Rinpoche had to say, and that is... Whoops. 35. Okay. He says, whatever comfort, wealth, beauty, and power you enjoy today is the result of some minor good actions in a past life. However much of them you have, it is the characteristic of ordinary people never to feel satisfied. So we're getting here into the antidote for craving and attachment and desire. He says, you may have more wealth than you actually need. You may have triumphed over many opponents. You may have close relationships with friends and relatives, but it is never enough. That's the nature of attachment and desire. It's never enough. And the ultimate outcome of that is that when we die, we're propelled into the hungry ghost realm. And we never have anything we need in the hungry ghost realm. We're always suffering from deprivation. And it comes from being greedy, from always wanting more in this life. He says, even if coins of gold were to rain down on you from the sky, it would probably not be enough. He says, to know how to be satisfied with what you have is to possess true wealth. And I think we have that coming from somebody else, too. Geshe Jompa Tenchuk also has a very nice way of saying this. He says, so he told us about the three kinds of attachment to the past, present, and future. And he says, on many occasions, he says the same thing that Dingo Chenzi said. He said, if we have few desires, we will be satisfied. Whatever we have will be good enough and we will enjoy it. Contentment is a good quality to cultivate. On many occasions, the Buddha praised simplicity and contentment as the greatest possessions. That makes sense, right? Because if you're content with what you have, then you have everything you need. Simplicity means having few desires, not wanting a lot of things. And contentment is being satisfied and considering what we have to be good enough. So that's what we're aiming for. And Laminar Lorimbaje taught on that a lot, that the key to happiness is being happy with what you have. It's always, he taught this in New Hampshire, I remember, the first time he came. The key to happiness was always focusing on the ways in which other people have been kind to us and never focusing on what we, you know, the faults that we see in them. And he's often said that we need to be content with what we have. That's like the most important quality to cultivate, is contentment with what we have. And then we can turn our attention to really important things like Team Mother. Geshe Jampa Ketchum also addresses like the extreme end of desire, which is you know, along the lines of addiction. He said, when under the influence of intoxicants, whatever they may be, ice cream can be an intoxicant, we lose all sense of integrity and consideration for others, due to which we act in many regrettable ways. So when we have that strong an attachment, we forget. You know, we forget Team Other completely. We just are completely enmeshed in Team I because the craving is so strong. And this is something that's very difficult to work with. So again, you know, on the spectrum of attachments, possible attachments, we always start the same way as with anger. We recognize, like, instead of acting immediately, instead of jumping, like, got to get the ice cream out of the freezer now, we take a moment and we go, ah, I'm experiencing a craving for something. And that gives us space right there. Just that thought gives us space. And then we can think, what do I want to do now? Do I, as Pema Chodron says, you ask yourself, is this what I want to reinforce? Like for this lifetime and for future lifetimes, is this what I want to reinforce, this craving, this habit that's only caused me suffering in the end? Like, I'm going to enjoy that ice cream right now, and then I'm going to suffer afterwards. If we can think ahead like that, it's really helpful. And again, as we see again and again, if we can just think Team Other, like what would Team Other do in this situation? Team Other would refrain from, you know, getting into a state in which I'm going to harm someone that I love. It's going to cause suffering to someone that I love. So that could be another reinforcing factor. But there's a lot of tools, and we have to, you know, we just have to find which ones help us and put them into practice as much as we can. So let's see. Do we have anything else on verse 21? Yeah, okay, so the last thing I have on 21 is from Kenpo Sultram Jamsa Rinpoche, which I thought was really helpful. He says something that nobody else said. He said, so the advice in verse 21 is, as soon as that feeling of attachment arises and we recognize it, there's the key, and we recognize it, we drop the object. We just put distance between ourselves and the object immediately. We don't indulge it at all. There's this lovely saying that I ran across recently that I can't, it was actually a Mahamudra text, I think, that is an Asian saying, you know, you have to keep the hog out of the garden, because once the hog gets into the garden and starts eating, like, it's over. It's much harder to tame them, much harder to get them out. So that's the advice, is drop it like a hot potato as soon as you recognize it. Difficult to do. Difficult to do, but once you let that hog get at the carrots, it's over. You're never going to get them out of the garden again. So anyway, here's what Kenpo Sultram Jamsa has to say. There are two ways of relinquishing sense objects, two ways of dropping it. They require different levels of skill, so sometimes one may be called for and sometimes the other. He says one way to relinquish sense objects is literally to give them up. And the other is to abandon attachment to them. Because, as we know, it's not the objects themselves that bring us suffering and cause us to harm others. It's our attachment to it. So one is literally to give them up. And that's what monastics do. They just, like, just get out of there. Like, I don't even want to be, like, exposed to this stuff anymore. Because that will help me develop a different habit. So you can give them up, or you can keep them. Keep the objects and just give up the attachment. So he gives the example of Milarepa as literally giving it up. He says Milarepa actually gave up all sense pleasures to meditate in solitude. He didn't need or want them. Like, he didn't have to worry about ice cream. because he didn't have it. He only had nettles, and you don't become addicted to nettles, I'm pretty sure. But Marp, on the other hand, who was Milarepa's teacher, abandoned only his attachment to the five sense pleasures. He lived a normal householder's life, enjoying all the pleasures of the senses. Though he indulged in everything, Marpa was attached to nothing, for he realized all sense pleasures to be a dream and an illusion. He was thus able to completely relinquish clinging to them. In fact, Marpa took sense pleasures onto the path, using them as a practice. And then there was Gampopa, a monk. Gampopa decided to adopt a half and half approach, because as we know, he brought the monastic tradition together with the Mahamudra yogic tradition from Milarepa. He gave up half of the sense objects. The other half he understood to be without any essence, no more than a dream and an illusion. And I'm not exactly sure what Gampopa is referring to there, but we will take his word for that. Gampopa did half and half. So I would just say, if it's like a small scale desire thing, then we could certainly experiment with, can I keep indulging? Can I just have one potato chip? You know, can I just have one small dish of ice cream and walk away from the rest? If it's a really strong addiction, like the first bite of ice cream and you're going to eat the gallon, then you might need to do the literal thing and just not have ice cream in the house. So anybody got any questions or comments? We're going to spend the next 10 minutes or so on how to actually apply this in practice. Does anybody have anything to say or ask before we look at that? John, I'm unmuting you. Okay.
I can see here that the analogy is drinking salt water. And that reminds me of another analogy, and I don't know where that is in the 37 verses, but I know it's where I heard it. I'm not sure about licking honey from a razor blade. Is that similar?
It's not in the 37 practices, but it's a very classic way. It's probably in Gampopa. You may have encountered it in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. That analogy. It's when the three types of suffering are explained is usually the context for it, and it's a metaphor for how all of our pleasures are really suffering in disguise. So you see the honey and you lick it, but really underneath it's a very sharp blade, so it hurts you. Okay, that's it. Okay, anybody else? All right, so let me see what I have for the practices. Okay, we're gonna look at Ringu Tulku, which you probably don't have on hand. Marilyn and Patrick would have it if they were in California. On 102. This is in the Meditation Paramita. And it is, Marilyn and Patrick will remember this because we did this fairly recently at KDC. So in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, Gampopa's guidebook to liberation, he tells us how to meditate. And he says, and this is in the words of Ringu Tulku, who's retelling it. He says, the first stage of taming whatever our emotion is to recognize which mental poison affects us the most. Is it possessiveness? I guess that would be like desire, hatred, or ignorance? To counteract the dominant poison, we should apply the appropriate antidote. The following three methods are the traditional techniques recommended by most Buddhist schools. So I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but basically the idea is when you're actually meditating on the cushion, you can replicate this so that when you encounter situations in real life that trigger your emotional reaction, you will have had some practice in applying the methods for taming them. So you figure out which one is the strongest for you, whether it's anger, whether it's desire, attachment, whether it's ignorance, just being in a confused state, I guess, jealousy or pride. And so there's an antidote for each one. So if you have the Ornament of Precious Liberation or Ringu Tulku's Path to Buddhahood, you can look this up. It's on page 102 in Ringu Tulku. But basically, and I'll put this in my post, which I haven't finished yet. If if our biggest problem is attachment, we just always want more. We just always have to get another piece of furniture for our house or rearrange it, or we always need to update our wardrobe, or we always must have like a different food than we have on hand, and we always must have more of it. We're always in pain because we feel like we need something we don't have. The antidote, the classic antidote, is to meditate on the unattractive aspects of it. You know, if it's ice cream, you can think, I'll put on weight. But when we discussed this at KDC, it was felt that you could get in some sticky territory there because of the way that this was used by monks in the Hinayana. Basically, they were talking about desire to women. So you think about all the ugly things about women. But another way to apply this one is just think that it's impermanent. That's what we came up with, right, Patrick and Marilyn? Marilyn, just think it's impermanent. So you're really attracted to something. Say it is another person. You think they're going to get old. They're going to get old. They're going to have dementia, you know, like whatever it is. They're going to have bad habits. I'm going to hate, you know, I'm going to hate the thing about the cap on the toothpaste like 2 years from now. You just find the unattractive aspect or the impermanent aspect of it. So if it's anger, easy. And this, I have such a quibble with Ken McLeod about this. If it's anger, we meditate on loving kindness and compassion. And the way that that's taught, this is a blunt instrument approach. But it's very effective. If what we're trying to do is keep ourselves from accumulating negative karma and hurting another person, a blunt instrument may be what we need, that we're applying to ourselves, not to them. And the blunt instrument is love and compassion. You think about something that you love about the person, or you think about something, you know, your favorite pet, that brings love into your heart, which cuts into the anger. And Rinku Tulku and Gampopa say that anger and love cannot coexist. It's like heat and cold. Like either the room is cold or the room is hot or warm, but it can't be half warm and half cold at the same time. So your heart cannot hold anger and love and compassion at the same time. So we just turn our minds to compassion, however we can do that. And taking and sending is a really good way. If it's jealousy, we can use sympathetic joy, like be happy for their success. Think that they're like us, and we would be so happy to have what they have. Well, then we can put ourselves in their place through Others First or Team Other and rejoice for them, rejoice with them. And then pride, there's a different ways if it's pride. One is taking and sending. It's just you think of, you know, I'm not going to be able to formulate that one. I actually find that what's helpful for me there, it really comes down to taking and sending in this presentation. If you're feeling pride, then you think of other people. You simply turn your attention to others and focus on them, and you can do taking and sending. You can send them all the good stuff about yourself and take in all of the negativity that you see in them. You can also focus on your own faults. Like if you're feeling really puffed up about yourself, think of some of your faults and it'll deflate it right away. So anyway, that is those are the specific antidotes for our negative emotions. And I wanted to look very briefly at Ken Holmes on this same topic. He also has ways to work with. I think I forgot to bring my book in. Hold on a second. Have a meditation break. Well, I can't actually find my Ken Holmes. So anyway, we'll just reconstruct it. He basically says that there are three methods for working with anger, and presumably also you could apply them to desire. And one way is to experience it. So anger comes up and you just sit with the experience. Drop the storyline, sit with it, and just fully experience the emotion, which takes your mind off the storyline and off, you know, hurting the other person, if that's what you feel like doing. The second way is to employ it, and that's taking and sending. Like, you use your anger to collect all the anger of all sentient beings. Like, you actually do this. You actually say these words, may all the anger of all sentient beings be collected into this anger of mine, and may they be free from it. And then the third way is to transform it, which he says, so here's where we apply vipassana or lakshana or insight meditation. It begins by experiencing it. We drop the storyline, we recognize it, we drop the storyline, we feel the anger, and then instead of simply, like in the first method, just being with the anger until it dissipates, we use it to actually recognize the nature of mind by looking directly at the anger and asking, who's experiencing this anger? Like, where is the person or the thing that's experiencing this anger? Or what color, does it have a color? Does it have a shape? The same way that we would look at the mind, we can look at something that arises in the mind. Where I have a quibble with Ken MacLeod, and it could be that just I'm not understanding what he's saying, but he takes issue with Tokmei Zangpo here, and he says it's actually a mistake to raise an army of love and compassion. If we look at the wording of it, and I do have it memorized, I don't know if I can do it now. So sense pleasures and desires are like salt water. The more we drink them in, the more we crave. I must tame my mind by raising an army. I can't do it now in the verse, but it's to counter that, I raise an army of love and compassion to conquer my anger. And Ken says, no, that's not true, because that's just more aggression. It's using love and compassion in the service of aggression. But that's the metaphor that Tokmei Zangpo used, and it's a metaphor. And it works. It's the blunt instrument approach, but it works. You fill your heart with love and compassion. And we got that exact same advice, although not in military terms, in some of the earlier verses. Like, if someone slanders you, you repay them with love. If someone steals from you, you give them everything. You know, you're replacing the negative with the positive. And it's like it's not delicate surgery. It's like ripping it out, you know. But I think it's really useful. And it's where we begin. So I think that the metaphor is fine. I don't have a problem with it at all. I think it actually, it reminds me of the scene of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, you know, with the armies of Mara coming towards him and shooting arrows. And he does counter it with flowers, flowers of love and compassion. So anyway, I think that's what I've got. Anybody have anything that they would like to ask or say? Pardon me. All right. Joanne, I'm going to unmute you.
Since I'm a newcomer to your group, of course, I spent this period of time during your illness to back up a little bit. And what I encountered, and of course I consulted my son, is the 7 points of mind training that you alluded to in your email. And I was wondering if there's any way of acquiring, accessing Lama Karma Samden's presentation he did at the monastery in 2016 on the 7 points of mind training.
The way to acquire it would be to request from the audio department the recordings.
Okay, all right.
And do you know how to do that? It's just audio@kagyu.com.
Okay, if you could include that in your email to me about my previous request on the immeasurables, that would be very beneficial.
Okay.
Thank you, Lama.
Sure. Okay. Great. I will say, though, Lama Karma Samten is a Tibetan Lama who lives in New Zealand. He's lived in New Zealand for 20 years. He has a combination, he speaks English, very good English, with a combination of Tibetan and New Zealand accent. And he was so hard to understand in the first session that we then begged his assistant to restate everything he said and all the subsequent teachings. So the first teaching is a little hard to follow because his accent is so strong, but it's better after that.
Thank you.
Got it. Okay, anybody else have any requests or anything they'd like to share? All right. Well, then we'll go to Akshobhya. So I'm going to share the screen again. We'll do a few minutes of Akshobhya, and then we'll do our dedication and close out the class. So first of all, this is Akshobhya. He actually is blue. And if you look up Karmapa Akshobhya mantra on YouTube, there's an hour loop one. I think somebody was referring to that, where you see this on the screen. It's not the words of the mantra. Like, once you sort of know the words, you could actually bring this up. And this is a painting by the Karmapa, 17th Karmapa. And the color is not good in this reproduction. It's not my computer's fault, but the fault of the image that I had to go by. He actually does look blue. I actually have here. I have the same thing here. I don't know if you can see that it looks more blue. But anyway, Akshobhya is blue. And this is his Nirmanakaya form. Like, that's the same as the form of a Buddha. But he also exists in a Sambhogakaya form, more like Chenrezig with ornate ornaments and so forth. So can everybody see that? I can't really make it much bigger. The blue is the mantra, and we're just going to do the mantra. And I'm not going to be doing it with, like, the tune that the Karmapa used or anything like that. We're just going to do it. And also, the Karmapa uses a Sanskrit pronunciation, which is almost identical, but there's a couple of places where it's different. And we're going to use the Tibetan pronunciation, which is the transliteration here. So let me get mine. Mala. Got my mala. So we're going to try to do 21 Akshobhya mantras. We'll do them somewhat slowly since it's a sort of a hard mantra to do. So first, let's check in with our posture again. And relax into our body. Letting go of all thoughts, any sense of being anywhere else at this time, but just fully present with the mantra, with Akshobhya. Let's see if maybe I can get them both on the screen. Can everybody see the whole mantra? Okay, I'm going to assume you can. You'll have to unmute yours. I can't see all of you at the same time right now, so do let me know if you can't see the whole mantra on your screen. So thinking that Akshobhya is present with us in this space, we'll chant the mantra. And just to say that you may have already picked this up from other things, Akshobhya is the Buddha whose name means imperturbable, unmovable, unshakable. This is complete freedom from the conflicting emotions, complete freedom from hatred, complete freedom from anger, desire, ignorance, jealousy, pride, all completely dissolved into equanimity. And we learn about that in Gampopa, that that's the definition of patience. Like, the ultimate definition of patience is to be imperturbable, not disturbed mentally by anything. So that is Akshobhya. And he is, like, a lot of times this practice is done to counteract anger. Om namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya heyata om kam kani rotsani trochani trochani chasani chasani chatihana chatihana sarva karma paramparanime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya heyata om kam kani rotsani tro trani tro trani tra sani tra sani trati hana trati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva satam en sasoha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani ro tsani tro chani tro chani tra sani tra sani chatihana chatihana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soa namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani rotsani rotsani tro chani tro chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani ro tsani tro chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani ro tsani cho chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani ro tsani cho chani cho chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani kham khani ro tsani cho chani cho chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani ro tsani cho chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranini sarva sato nensa soha namo bhagavate akshobhya tathagataya arhate samyak sambuddhaya hayata om kham khani ro tsani cho chani cha sani chati hana chati hana sarva karma param paranime sarva sato nensa soha. Now we'll just let our minds rest for a moment in equanimity, mixing our mind once again with the Lama's mind, the Buddha's mind. Mm-hmm. And now we will do our dedication for us. And then if anybody has anything else to say, I will unmute everybody. Dedicating all the merit from this study and practice and contemplation to the enlightenment of all beings. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my foes, the enemy, and from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, and to Zampo and Manjushri, to train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of Changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the Steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And letting our minds rest again for a moment. And now I'll unmute everybody in case anybody has anything they would like to say. Okay, you're all unmuted. So for the next, for the 49 days, I haven't calculated the 49 days yet for Lamanar Rinpoche. They haven't.
I think it's April 8th.
Okay, good.
I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, other people have calculated that. Okay. Usually it's like whatever the day of the week is. You go 7 days ahead and then back one day. So it should be on a Sunday.
Yep, April
8th. Yeah, April 8th is a Sunday. So that should be April. Yeah, April 8th, right? Gosh.
Yeah.
That seems so soon.
I know.
But anyway, for that period of time, thank you guys for doing that. I'm going to send that in my next update. For that 49-day period, the Lama is very much present according to tradition. So whenever we let our minds rest, we could think that we could be receptive to mixing our minds with the mind of enlightenment. Okay, anybody have anything? Joanne?
Therefore, may I use Lama Lorla as a root Lama during May?
If you feel that connection with him, you definitely may.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it's usually said that the root Lama is the one who points out the nature of mind to you, and or the one that you feel the closest connection with. And it doesn't keep you from, you know, having devotion to other Lamas as well. But usually there is one that sort of, you know, for me, he was the first Lama I met, and I was with him for 40 years. He's definitely my root Lama, and he did give me pointing out instructions. So, all right. Anybody else? Oh, Deidre, yes.
I just want to say how nice it is today to see everybody. It's very hard to not be with a Sangha right now, you know, because we're all so scattered. So this has been very nice, and I can see him in all of us, and that's very comforting.
Thank you, Deidre. I feel the same. I was really looking forward to seeing everybody today, too. I do have a Sangha as well, Dan and I. Have a song that mentioned, so although Dan's busy with Clementine and his
I fault, never get to come.
Well, you will. Yeah. You're doing other practice right now that's extremely important.
True. I'll be there. I'll be with you guys this Thursday and as you said, in spirit. So
yeah, in spirit, yes. All right. Anybody else have anything you'd like to say before we close?
Thank you, Lama.
Thank you, Lama.
Thank you.
And thank you all. We're all on the path together. I'm very happy to, you know, be treading it alongside you all. So anyway, I'll see you next week for this class. And then I think the following week we have our online meditation class happening, which hopefully nothing will change that again.
Good.
So I will exercise my superpower then.
Thank you.
Bye.
Everybody. And I'll send that email.